Welcome to the Siemens Future Car Podcast. And today, we're going to go beyond just talking about autonomous cars, but we're going to investigate the world of autonomous and connected cars. And we have with us, from Siemens Intelligent Traffic Systems, the representative for that group in Detroit, the Motor City. I'd like to welcome Eric Ganaway.
Well, thanks, Ed.
So, Eric, just to start off, maybe you could tell us a little bit about your background and how you ended up at Siemens Intelligent Traffic Systems.
Yeah, it was kind of interesting. I would say thanks to LinkedIn, as a matter of fact. I was working in the traffic business for another company. Actually, I got a call from Siemens based on my LinkedIn account. They said, we're going to begin a work in Detroit, in Michigan, and it looks like you might be a good fit for it. Are you interested? It's history from there. It's been a great opportunity and a lot of fun so far, too.
Have you been in the automotive industry all your life or more on the software side, hardware? How do you pull all of this together?
Well, actually, I was in the automotive side. The manufacturing side is where I came from. Honestly, as the industry began to take a downturn, I was looking for a plan B. I had an opportunity to get into the transportation side of it with a new startup company that was creating an adaptive traffic control product. And it was pretty intriguing. And that's how I got in. So for the last 10 years or so, I've been on the transportation side instead of the manufacturing side.
Well, you know, when we talk about technology, there's always this focus on the software or the hardware. And sometimes people forget that in the end, it's actually about the people. How technology and all these innovations are going to make life better for people. And the people that really matter are probably the ones that are going to be using this technology in the future. And I think you've had some interesting conversations recently, I believe, with one of your grandchildren about what all this might be about when it becomes a reality sometime, 10, 20 years from now.
Yeah. And that's the way I described it to him. I do have a grandson that has spina bifida, and he's paralyzed from the waist down. So periodically, I will pick him up and take him someplace. But, you know, he spends most of his time when he's traveling with somebody else taking him around. And one day I was taking him to school, and I said, you know, Quinn, it's not going to be that long before you'll get on your phone and you'll call a vehicle with an app, and it'll pull up out front. You'll get in, and it'll take you wherever you want to go. And we had some conversations after that, and I said to him, how do you think about a vehicle pulls up, you get in, and you watch a movie or play a game, and you go wherever you want to go? And he says, that's what I do every day when I get in the car. I get in, and it takes me wherever I want to go. So it made me think of the generation that's coming up. These kids spend all their time doing something else. They get in, and the vehicle takes them wherever they want to go. So it may not be that big of a stretch for them to call a vehicle on their app and have it come, because somebody's driving them around all the time anyway.
It almost seems like the future, like you're saying, is not that big of a change for them. So it's only going to impact the change is really going to happen to the people that are used to driving, right? Not the ones that are the passengers.
No, I think that's exactly right. And my thought started to head down the path of, you know, if we're looking at vehicles and talking about the future and designing them, probably the ones that we should be talking to are those people that are going to be using them. And it is the 10-year-old, you know, and the 8-year-old. What do you want to see in a future vehicle? They're the ones that are going to get in, get on their phone, watch a movie, and ride someplace, and maybe never get a driver's license.
And here's where intelligent traffic systems are really more generally connected vehicles. As you said, your grandson gets in the car, he's playing a game, or maybe he's texting or surfing on the net, whatever it might be. Can you tell us a little bit about connected vehicles? How are they related to autonomous vehicles? How are they different? A lot of times people take connected vehicles and autonomous vehicles and they just throw them into that one big bin. But they're really two different technologies that work together, right?
Yeah, they really are. As we discover more and more what connected means, I think it means if you get in your car and you start it up and you're navigation service comes on and tells you where you're located, you're connected. If you can get on your cell phone and lock your doors in your car or start your car, you're connected. I get a little message from the car dealership that I bought it that says, hey, we told you it's time to get an oil change. Connected vehicles, if you've got internet, your vehicle is connected. It's gathering data, and that data is being stockpiled, right? The manufacturer is using that data. The dealerships are using that data. It's where it goes from there. But that's a big portion of it, is all of the sensors and all of the technology that's really in the vehicles we're driving now that makes it connected. There's a company that came out that does a valet parking service. They will turn your 2012 or newer vehicle into an autonomous vehicle. They can do that, and it'll park itself based on the connected technology that's in your car already. So I'm not sure we're that far away. I mean, they turn it into a level 4 autonomous vehicle, and you can do that today.
So when it comes to having your vehicle connected and they're collecting data from it, in some ways, that's a little scary, right? Everyone's concerned these days, even like on social media, right? Oh, what information are they collecting about me? How are they going to use it? How do you balance that against, you know, what benefits am I getting as a driver or a passenger if my vehicle's connected? What are the trade-offs there?
You know, we believe we're creating safer vehicles and we're moving towards, you know, a zero death and a zero crash, you know, population. That's where we hope we're going. And so I think that's the upside for us, driving a connected vehicle, the convenience of knowing, you know, that your blind spot detection is working and that maybe you can't back into someone because you have park assist or backup assist. There's a lot of features that cause us to be safer in general. I think the trade-off, and that can be because of that data is being collected, you know, the conversations go, what does that do to our car insurance? It should lower car insurance rates. And that may, based on the amount of safety features you have, but being connected, how hard you hit the brakes and how often you hit the brakes, that information's being collected. How fast you go if you exceed the speed limit. If you've got a vehicle that tells you what the speed limit is, and then the little sign turns red when you go over the speed limit, that information's being collected. So I think what we see is even though we're being safer, I think car insurance companies, for example, can turn around and say, whoa, maybe we don't charge you enough. It looks like you go into the city a little more than we thought you might go into. So you said you go 20 miles to work, but we didn't realize you went 20 miles into a bad area. Maybe your premium should be a little higher. So I think that information can be used, we'll say for the good, but, and no doubt, it could be a little more costly for us, you know, in the long run.
Well, if you're a good driver, though, it could be to your benefit, I suppose, right? They could see that you're a good driver and you're saying maybe reduce my insurance rates.
Yeah. But the insurance companies make money on the good drivers and they lose money on the bad drivers. And you can be a good driver and it might be the minority, those that don't go over the speed limit, that don't hit the brakes very hard. I haven't had any accidents in a long, long time, but I do have some hit the brake pretty hard, you know, incidents, which may indicate those are near misses, right? Possibly, as far as the insurance company is concerned. And to them, that may be just as good as an accident. No doubt somebody could benefit from it, but it almost looks like the insurance company is not going to take a hit based on, you know, these connected vehicle features. We very well might be the ones.
And when you think of connected vehicle features, isn't there another side where a connected vehicle can, you know, bring in entertainment like Netflix or Apple TV or the, you know, the latest game that's being played in town? That's a piece of it as well, right?
Yeah, it is. And the ability to connect your phone, connect all your communications to it. You do have an entertainment center on wheels. You have that ability to be able to conduct all your business and your entertainment all in the vehicle. And when you can do that, once again, if you've got internet, you have a connected vehicle. There is a fun upside to it, but the reality side is that it's probably going to not change much. I don't think things will get so much cheaper. The cost of technology and maybe replacing it will cause, you know, some things to get a little more expensive, but there's a lot of fun upside to it.
You have this idea, right? When autonomy comes in, you're not driving, so you could watch movies, say, or play games on the windshield or a big screen that you have inside the vehicle. But if you have a driver in the car, you have to be real careful, I would imagine, where you place that screen so you don't distract the driver. And right now, almost all cars that are on the street are conventional cars with drivers. So how do you see this evolving? Because it seems that right now, vehicles could be connected. You could start streaming entertainment to these vehicles. But will that really happen until they become autonomous? How do you see connected vehicle technology and autonomous vehicle technology evolving so I can have that entertaining ride?
Yeah, I think as long as it's connected, I think everybody in the car is entertained but you. When it's autonomous, I think you get it. You do get it. But I'll tell you what, until you get to level 4 autonomy anyway, I still don't think you get to enjoy the movie. You're still responsible to keep your eyes on the road in case you have to take control. So that full relaxing entertainment experience, it might be out there a little farther.
You know, here in Boston, they've been testing autonomous vehicles for quite some time. And that's exciting, you know, even though it may be a ways out before they're accessible to everyone everywhere in Boston. But just recently, I heard in the news that they're very excited about synchronizing using the latest technology. And I'm sure this comes from Intelligent Traffic Systems at Siemens as well, but synchronizing the traffic lights. And there's nothing more annoying than getting a green light and going one block and getting a red one and back and forth and back and forth till it, you know, takes you forever to go through 5-6 city blocks. The whole idea of vehicles talking to traffic lights, talking to a master traffic control brain, that's one of the key things that you get from an intelligent traffic system. Can you tell us a little bit of what Siemens has done in this area?
Yeah, we're very proud of the fact that we have a Scoot system, and it is an adaptive system.
What does Scoot actually mean?
It means split cycle and offset optimization. And those are the controls that traffic signal controllers use to control the pattern, the phasing, and the timing at intersections.
Does that mean I'm always going to have green lights wherever I go?
Only if you work for Siemens.
Well, there's an incentive to work for Siemens. So what does Siemens ITS do, you know, in this area of making that traffic flow better? I want to get rid of those red lights that are annoying me. I'd love to have 10 green lights in a row. How does this intelligent traffic systems make that happen?
Well, it happens really through a series of detection systems that are at intersections, and it monitors the flow of traffic. And so it'll notify the central system the speed the traffic's moving at, the volume, or the capacity of the intersection, and it can make adjustments to traffic timing on the fly. If it sees that it's taking longer to clear traffic through an intersection, it can actually make some adjustments to extend the green time. It will also prevent, in a learned type situation, it'll learn over the course of a couple of minutes what traffic is doing, and it finds out we have more people that are making a left turn and we're not actually clearing the left turn lanes, it'll begin to make some adjustments and hold traffic coming back from the opposing direction to try to clear that out. So it actually optimizes traffic by making real-time traffic adjustments, and it's done through detection and automatic adjustments in the timing plan. There's a central server that stores this information and begins to analyze it and then makes those shifts and changes. So in the morning, if traffic is heavy in the northbound, it'll actually make the changes to optimize northbound traffic. And if it find out that in the evening in the southbound traffic is picking up, it'll turn around and readjust those to optimize traffic going the opposite direction.
It sounds like there's some sort of a master traffic brain or something that's all knowing of where all the cars are, and based on that it makes adjustments.
Yeah, and it does it based on the way and the time that vehicles enter the intersection. Across that stop bar, you know, you'll see when you're sitting in an intersection, they put a big, generally white line across there. And that's kind of a measurement point. If there's something sitting there and it detects it, it will make the, it uses that as the point of counting vehicles as it goes across. It will actuate a signal if there's somebody sitting there telling them that there's someone waiting. You know, let's give this person a turn. But there is a software system. It's a matter of the controller in the cabinet runs the signal time and the phasing. And then there is kind of that master brain that analyzes all this and tries to make intelligent decisions as to who should get to go and who's going to have to wait a little longer.
I was a little surprised that a city like Boston is only now deploying a technology like this. Are there cities that are doing this right now? Is it commonplace? It sounds like a great technology. You would think everyone would be wanting technology like this in their city as soon as possible. There's nothing more annoying than driving in a city with heavy traffic.
Yeah, and you know, there's a lot of cities that are doing it. There's probably a few thousand intersections in the United States, which sounds like a lot. There's 330,000 traffic signals, but there's a few thousand that have this type of technology. Some cities are so congested, they're saturated, you can't really do anything other than give people a turn. And so sometimes an adaptive system doesn't work in a very saturated situation like that. It's in areas where they don't want to pour more pavement. Sometimes that's the only way that you can ease up traffic is to give people more lanes or take advantage of the pavement that you have and optimize traffic so people are moving at the right speeds. If we can keep them moving in platoons, you keep moving. You don't create the carbon footprint that we do. We save a lot of time. We save a lot of fuel by doing that. Not every intersection or sometimes corridor is a candidate, but more and more are, and there's a price that's attached to it. And sometimes it takes a while for cities to decide what that return on their investment is going to be. But no doubt from the standpoint that you're saving on fuel, and that's big consideration, you're saving on time. Even changing the time by on a corridor for 6 or 7 minutes a day that you've increased someone's commute time, you're saving hours. You're saving a week's worth of time for someone at the end of the year. And that's a valuable offset. And there's a price that's associated with that. So if they can justify that, you see it. And Boston has just been able to justify the cost, I believe.
So, Eric, the benefits you just described seem tremendous. However, there's 330,000 traffic lights in the United States, but only a few thousand have actually been converted. With such great benefits, why is that the penetration of this technology so small?
It's the cost of implementing it is what it is. The government has made money available, a lot of money available, for a community or a city to put a plan together, show a justification for how much they believe that they can reduce congestion. There is a formula that does calculate hours of travel time reduced, that congestion, that carbon footprint, what the cost of that is, the cost of wasted fuel by sitting at traffic lights. If they can show reduction, the government has money available for them to implement that. So sometimes it's a co-op type. You know, the government may pay 80%, you pay 20%. And you know, over the last few years, many cities and municipalities have had a hard time even coming up with the 20% because tax bases have dropped, you know, jobs had disappeared. We're just starting to make a comeback. And so some communities are in a little better shape to do it, but it's generally the money that prevents it from happening.
You know, one thing you hear about these days, speaking of money, is congestion charging. Right. They do it in London. There's talk of New York and other cities considering it. That could be one way of raising some money, right? How does congestion charging, does that work together somehow with connected vehicles or other regulations? Is there a way that you can combine some of these things to make the green wave occur sooner rather than later?
That would help. I think initially the congestion charging was, those dollars were supposed to help improve the infrastructure because it's really a tax or a toll that was supposed to help make some of those adjustments.
Did that not happen? Did that money go elsewhere?
Well, again, you said in London, I'm not really sure where the money's going. I know in New York City, what they're talking about doing, they'll geofence in some areas and you'll pay a toll when you come in and go out. And ideally, what it should do is it should mean you and I ride to work in the morning. Instead of taking two vehicles, we take one.
What's a geofence?
I guess it would be an internet or even a satellite radio type of area that's designated that vehicles would be detected as they enter this area or they try to leave that area, that signals or tolling or certain information would be broadcast as you approached it or as you went through that area. That's the best of my knowledge.
Let's talk a little bit about vehicle-to-infrastructure communication. How does that help an autonomous car navigate? For instance, you know, does it help it see around a corner or anticipate that pedestrians are going to be somewhere? How does that work to make an autonomous car safer and more reliable?
Well, the autonomous vehicles, you know, they're loaded with sensors. Again, the sensors is the connected part of the vehicle. Its ability to sense oncoming traffic around the corner, it can sense vehicles coming. It can also, from the detection that's in an intersection, be notified if a vehicle is coming at a rate of speed and it doesn't appear that it's going to stop. It'll receive dedicated short-range radio communication, DSRC, from the intersection saying there could be a collision, there could be a red light runner coming. That's based on the information of the vehicle coming, the speed and trajectory of your vehicle, and what's happening at the intersection at the same time. Those vehicles will make a decision saying, I don't think this other guy can stop, sends you a notice and tells you to be on the lookout. So it's a combination of that sensory detection and the vehicle's ability to communicate.
Can it also see pedestrians that are crossing the street and anticipate that they're going to jump from the curb onto the street or jump out from between a couple of parked cars and let a car know that may happen soon, so it keeps not only the driver and the car safer, but also the pedestrians?
I think with the video camera algorithms that are being created now, vehicles have a tendency to see something and identify it, but there is external detection and algorithms that will look and notice a pedestrian. It can see that the pedestrian has his arm bent, make an assumption it's on the phone, make the assumption it may not be paying attention based on the rate that it's moving, and send the vehicle a notice. This would come from external detection and tell them there's a pedestrian that's going to enter the intersection, or beware, or there is a pedestrian in the intersection. It may see it, and that can happen externally. Now, the vehicle itself has the ability more and more through AI to be able to identify objects like pedestrians, know the difference between a person and an animal, for example. I think what happened, just for example, you know, when the Uber vehicle hit, you know, that unfortunate accident that hit someone and killed them, the vehicle was having a hard time determining whether it was an object, an animal, a person. And by the time it did, it wasn't set up to notify the driver to take over, you know, and make a decision. So the vehicle was struggling with what it was. It couldn't make that decision. External detection can be set up to make those types of decisions and get it to the vehicle in enough time for it to make a decision.
One of the things you're starting to see in cities now is a multimode transportation or ability to choose different types of transportation. So multimodal transportation that could be a car or a shuttle or a scooter or maybe a subway. And, you know, Siemens has intelligent traffic systems. They also, they build trains, subways. How do intelligent traffic systems help in this multimodal world? If I wanted to take a ride on a bus and a train, how does all that work together to get me from point A to B?
Well, and Siemens has all that technology and has the ability to schedule all of those modes of transportation, you know, from one app on a phone. And its ability to do that would be to call up an autonomous vehicle, would be to schedule a scooter or an Uber, for that matter of fact. If it's an autonomous vehicle, the app would be able to call that particular vehicle. It would identify and register the rider when it got on the vehicle. You would have pre-programmed the destination. Of course, it would automatically take you, you know, to where you were going to go. I think it's important from a that congestion standpoint that we were starting to talk about a little bit. With they're all different types of ride-sharing programs. That's where the reduction in congestion is going to come from. That's where the ability for autonomous vehicles, I think, is really going to come from by removing a lot of the other types of traffic, by clearing out the roadway itself. And that'll happen with scooters and some of the autonomous shuttles. And there's supposed to be an air taxi company, I think, in 2025. The city of Miami is already building rooftop landing zones. Whenever you do something like this, it takes more vehicles off the street, makes it easier for us to get around, and makes it easier for autonomous vehicles.
I would love an app where it does all the thinking, like, okay, Ed, you will start off with an Uber, and then you're going to take the red line to this location, and the subway will drop you off, and you can pick up an electric bike there for that last 10 minutes to get you to your destination. Do apps like that exist today?
Yeah, they do. And we have an app with Bitemark that has the ability to do just that. And in fact, I believe that we're participating in Smart City in Columbus, Ohio. I think that we're using that app. It will show all the registered transportation that's available. The great thing is, just like you said, you put where you want to go, it schedules the modes of transportation. You pay for it right there all at one time. Then again, your phone is your registration to be able to take, you know, all those vehicles.
So we've been talking about a lot of big changes, autonomous vehicles, connected vehicles, changes to the streets that they drive on, the traffic lights, whatever it might be. What do you think the future of employment in the automotive industry is going to be like? What will engineers be doing? It sounds like they're not only going to be engineering cars, they'll probably be engineering the streets that these cars are connected to. What's the future of employment in the automotive industry going to be like?
It's going to morph. You know, we know that, and I think it is a little unknown. We're probably going to lose, you know, 10%, maybe 5% of the workforce that's driving vehicles. Those people that drive for a living, you're probably not going to have the cabs that you had and some of even the big trucks that you have. So auto production is going to go down. I think as we begin to build vehicles for this autonomous market, the industry has a tendency to believe that even though we have autonomous vehicles, Ed, you and I may choose to buy one because we only use our car 5 or 10% of the time anyway. And so the smart move would be for us to own one. And while we're sitting here doing this, our vehicles is a shared ride now, and it's out making money for us. So you may pay $80,000 for that car, and it'll turn around and turn a profit probably in less than a year for you if that's what you want to do. On the flip side, because that vehicle's gone all the time, maintenance is still going to be there. Right now, autonomous vehicles are handled with kid gloves, right? Every time one comes in, it's pampered and it's washed and it's clean and it's checked and everything's updated. But vehicles aren't going to stop for very long. We know some of the shuttle companies, they'll run a dozen shuttles someplace because shuttles have to come in for maintenance while other shuttles are on the road because they're running all the time. So I think what we're going to see is, I think the aftermarket maintenance, I think it's going to stay strong. I think the automotive companies are going to be building shared vehicles. You still have your mechanical engineers, you got your electrical engineers, you've got your computer scientists for sure. Those are probably going to be the big jobs, but you're still going to have production, probably not at the level that it is, but I think people are going to shift into different areas. I think we're going to feel the pain a little bit in the beginning, but then I think it's going to settle in. I think those jobs are going to surface, mainly because vehicles are being used so much more than they're being used now. So I think it's going to offer a lot of opportunity.
So in one way, the vehicles will last longer, so you have to produce fewer cars. But yet on the other hand, if autonomy especially, or even if connected technologies can make travel more affordable, you'll need more vehicles running at a certain time. It seems to be a shift from production maybe to servicing, cleaning, making sure that they stay up and running. That seems to be the major shift then.
I think so. But I know, you know, the big shift is going to be away from, you know, gas and diesel engines. It's going to be to electric engines. So it's going to be a different kind of maintenance. When a car runs 20 hours a day, I'm not sure that it lasts longer than a car that runs 2 hours a day. You know, so I think this is some of the unknown. The things that we're not going to see autonomous vehicles sitting in their driveway. I have 3 vehicles at my house. My wife leases, and I've got 10,000 miles a year on her lease. We'll turn it back in, and she'll still have 10,000 unused miles. You see that the way that we do this now, but it becomes an autonomous vehicle. If I could make money sharing her vehicle right now, and I felt, you know, comfortable doing it, believe me, that car would be on the road. So I think we're going to put more miles on a vehicle. I think it's going to have more wear parts and more maintenance. I think we're going to see it because those vehicles aren't going to sit around. They're going to be moving all the time because there's no reason for it to not.
It sounds like the Airbnb of cars.
I think that's what we'll see when people really get, I think the taxi driver and maybe the Uber driver buys his own car. And then he sits at home and watches the World Series while his car's out making money. I think you're going to see those kinds of things. You'll see people buy fleets same way.
We'll be all like mini Ubers then.
I think so. I think more so. You know, I was at a show in Detroit and I walked out and a woman that worked at Michigan Science Center asked me how the show was and how it went. And she said, I can't wait for autonomous vehicles because I can't see very well. She lives quite a ways away from where she works. That vehicle of hers sits in the parking lot right there, you know, all day long. And she, I guarantee, would be happy to have that car making money while she was gone. And she doesn't want to drive to work. She just wants to make sure she gets home safely.
Let me make sure I understand what you just said. You walked up to someone and they said they would love to have an autonomous car because they can't see very well, but then they walked over to their parked car and drove away?
They did. And I thought the same thing, Ed. Honestly, I watched her get in her car and drive away, and I thought, I'm going to let her get out of the parking lot before I go.
I think there's no better story to explain why autonomous cars will make things safer on our roads.
Absolutely.
You know, if I listen to everything you were just saying, I think about your grandson again. So when he turns 21, if he wants to be in the automotive industry, who knows what his job's going to look like then? It's not just going to be like the engineers of today or the mechanics of today, I guess.
No, you're right. And his job skills are probably part of his life skills, which is game playing. You know, he now spends a lot of time on his computer. He spends a fair amount on games, but he's doing tasks that he'll no doubt be able to do. You can be an electrical engineer. You know, you can be a computer scientist. I think coding and programming becomes so vital. It's a task that I think kids now can probably do, and they can do it fairly easy. There's another, I heard another aspect that I thought was kind of surprising too. Someone told me that they had broken the windshield on their car. When they replaced the windshield, it was quite an elaborate operation because of the video detection that you have, you know, that looks through the windshield, that the alignment of the windshield has become a very, very technical thing. You got to make sure that detection camera is not looking over the top of another vehicle or looking too low to miss something. It has to be, you know, this is the camera that keeps you between the lines going down the road with lane assist. So even those jobs are becoming a little, it's not the, I think I'll go get a job at the glass place. I think there's some technical skills that go along with it. It probably becomes a good career choice even.
This is one last question, and it's probably the most important question I'm going to ask you. When your grandson turns 21 or graduates from school, from college, he graduates from college, and you're going to give him an autonomous car for a gift, what would be the features in that car? What would you put in that car so that he's the happiest 23-year-old that is on Earth? What would it be?
It would be easy access for him would probably be the biggest. That's probably one of the biggest obstacles he has now, is having to transfer from a wheelchair into a vehicle and then being able to get into a seat. It's very difficult. So probably the access, comfort, the ability to navigate his destination, probably on the big screen. I'd like him to be able to get in if he needs to and type in on the screen the destination that he's going to, and then have whatever form of entertainment he wants while he's making that trip. So it would be comfort driven, I think, for the most part for him, something that he doesn't get to experience as much probably as other people do.
Eric, thank you so much for joining us today and just giving us a feel, a real feel of what it's going to be like in the future with connected and autonomous vehicles. Thank you for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.